Hello, it's Friday, November 4th, and you're watching Wing TV. I'm Lisa Giuliani. Victor Thorne and I are now very proud to present to you Mr. Webster Tarpley.
My partner in crime.
I would like, first of all, to express my appreciation to Wing TV for the idea of drawing up this anthology of 9/11 research and also for inviting me to be a part of it. I think that Wing TV has been providing an important public service to researchers and to the general public in fighting for truth about these important and highly controversial topics. And you've shown a great deal of courage, and all I can say is more power to you at Wing TV. Now, I've been asked to talk about the causes of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And I'm going to try to do this in a number of frames of reference, maybe one going back 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years, and another one going back much further, at least a century and perhaps more. Naturally, I have to say at the beginning that the causes of 9/11 have to be seen in regard to what 9/11 really was. The Kane-Hamilton Commission, the various congressional investigations are, of course, cover-ups and complete frauds. They have not laid a glove on any of the real perpetrators of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. I've written a book called 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA, published in 2005, in which I discuss the idea that these are the 9/11 attacks represent what we would call state-sponsored terrorism, false flag terrorism, synthetic terrorism. And I study them from the point of view of relating them to the spheres of influence or geopolitical terrorism conducted by NATO in Central Europe during the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s. So I am not relating to 9/11 as some fantastic story about bin Laden, Atta, a cave, a laptop, 19 supposed hijackers, and so forth. This was rather a provocation that matured in the bowels of the U.S. military and security establishment, coming from a rogue network, an invisible government or secret team that cuts across the various agencies, be it Pentagon, CIA, DIA, NSA, NRO, and so on down the line. Let's just say a few words about the Anglo-American system in general, because this is, I think, what we have to be concerned with. You've had, in the course of history, civilizations that have been based on generals, based on priests, based on bureaucrats, based on demagogues, based on mystics, even. The Anglo-American system is clearly an oligarchy based on financiers. It is a financier oligarchy, and even the term liberalism, which this system uses to describe itself in general, liberalism, as far as I can see, has really only one definition, the notion that financiers should rule a given society. It's an oligarchy. It really has no center. It may have a spokesman. There's a reason to think that George Shultz today is the spokesman for an oligarchical consensus. It's, after all, Shultz who appointed Bush president, chose his Vulcans, his Wolfowitz and Condi Rice and the rest of them, and then went on to choose Arnold Schwarzenegger to be governor of California. In the past, we've had people like Stimson or John McCloy or McGeorge Bundy or perhaps even David Rockefeller making an attempt which failed because of his lack of mental equipment. By the time we get into the end of the 90s and the beginning of the new millennium, looks to me like Shultz can be described not as the boss, certainly not as the dictator, but as a spokesman. Because remember, the Anglo-American system abhors the idea of dictatorship. And all of this goes back to the Venetian Republic, which is to some degree the source, the ultimate origin of the British Whig financier oligarchy, which ruled the world starting in the late 1600s, and indeed ruled the world for 200 years or so. So it's a system based on oligarchical financier domination. Now, in the American case, you have a strange dualism because you have a constitutional system which has many, many positive features, but you've also got this other side, the invisible government, the secret government, the rogue network, the secret team, the parallel government, the shadow government, and so on down the line. Where does it come from? Well, according to my research, it's been around at least 150 years. I would date the first noticeable action by the invisible government as the Mexican War back in the late 1840s, when President James K. Polk sent a guy called Stockton to Texas to try to start a war illegally outside of the constitutional chain of command. This was disrupted by the Civil War, but by the end of the century, by about 1890 or 1895, you've got a coming together of the two wings, the Confederate wing and the New York financier wing, in a kind of a personal union around Theodore Roosevelt, who had a Confederate mother and a patroon financier father. So there you have the thing coming together. What do? As soon as they're constituted, they start a war with Spain and found an American empire. Imperialism starts with the blowing up of the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor. And of course, this was blamed by the Hearst press on the Spanish, but this is, of course, an absurd story. The Spanish had no interest in doing this, and a more recent study by Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of the U.S. nuclear navy, concluded that the explosion on the Maine came from inside the ship, not from outside, and therefore it's an inside job, quite literally. The interest involved here, however, is not really a strictly U.S. one. The big issue around 1900 was the Spanish Empire, with Cuba, the Philippines, and other key islands around the world. The main issue was that the British did not want Germany to get a hold of those islands. So the British were willing to sponsor and help to launch an American imperialism as a kind of a counterweight to the German one, which they thought they would have a more difficult time controlling. So notice, at the inception of the modern phase of the invisible government, the British influence, very noticeable, the role of the mass media with Hearst being extremely important because it's his hysteria that built up the popular consent for war. President McKinley, relatively reluctant to get involved, but caving in under the pressure of this invisible government. As we take it further, we can see the invisible government growing through the Federal Reserve Act, under Woodrow Wilson in particular. By the time we get to Roosevelt, you've got something like the Morgan coup of the early 1930s, where a financier grouping who were not happy with Roosevelt explored the idea of having their own Mussolini March on Rome, that is to say, instituting an actual American fascism in the early 1930s, and they were dissuaded when this was exposed and otherwise proved to be unworkable. The invisible government, to the extent that it was ruled by these financiers and then also expressed through military and intelligence people, were by and large strongly pro-fascist in the case of Mussolini and very, very strongly pro-Hitler. You can see that in the Dulles brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, people like this representing the Wall Street banking community. Also Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current tenant of the White House, who is, of course, known for his role in financing Hitler's seizure of power and in otherwise supporting Nazism and indeed profiting from Nazism. The hallmarks of the invisible government in the post-war phase are founding the Cold War, creating a Cold War with the Soviets, which was not, strictly speaking, necessary, but which fit the British desire to be important quite well. And then by the time we get into the Kennedy period, you can see at the beginning of the 1960s a grouping around Alan Dulles, General Lyman Lemnitzer, General Ed Lansdale. Alan Dulles, of course, the CIA, the Dulles brothers. Lemnitzer, the signer of Operation Northwoods, the plan for a terrorist provocation to get a war with Cuba. He then went on to become the head of NATO, where he instituted Gladio in Italy and similar terrorist teams with arms caches in all of the important European countries, which then became the basis of terrorism, allegedly anti-communist, but really just U.S. invisible government, geopolitical spheres of influence. Terrorism, be it the Red Brigades, the Moro kidnapping, the Baader-Meinhof group in Germany, and so on down the line. If we can just tick off a series of events like the Bay of Pigs, the Kennedy assassination, the Gulf of Tonkin incident leading to the Vietnam War, we can add in events like the Watergate scandal. We can add in such events as the overthrow of the Shah of Iran and the Iran-Contra scandal. We can add in events in the 1990s like the bombing of Serbia and related things. So what we see is a series of provocations, intelligence operations, and so forth, carried out by this secret government. Notice the tendencies that they have is they seek military solutions, they're aggressive, they're militaristic, they're on the attack, and their preferred weapons, however, are oblique warfare, guerrilla, small-scale, low-intensity terrorist operations, provocations, coup d'etat, and this sort of thing. So it used to be, for example, during the Iran-Contra period, we had Senator Inouye coming out and saying there's an invisible government that has its own army, its own navy, its own treasury, its own State Department, its own notion of what the national interest is. Eisenhower complained about the industrial-military complex. President Truman in the 1960s complained about the fact that the CIA had gotten to be powerful beyond any measure and far beyond its original statutory tasks. You had articles in the Herald Tribune in New York in the mid-60s talking about an invisible government. And again, during Iran-Contra, this became pretty much open knowledge. So on September 11th, 2001, I was actually in Berlin, Germany. I heard about the events in the afternoon, and the first thing I said is, oh my God, it's them. It's the Iran-Contra drug-running, gun-running, terrorist operation asserting itself in a new form of desperation, attempting to steer the world towards a world war. And, of course, that is, I think, the only conceivable explanation, because those are the only people that have the power to produce those events that you observe. Now, the causes for all this, the causes, I think you have to frame them in a broad sense. It's the decline of Anglo-American world domination. First of all, it's a military strategic decline, because it ultimately always comes down to violence for these people. Since they worship warfare, glorify violence and power, military considerations are always important to them. In 1992, you have the Wolfowitz Doctrine, where Wolfowitz says, now that the Soviet Union has collapsed, the U.S. fundamental interest is to make sure that nobody ever appears as a kind of antagonist on a world scale in the sense that the Soviet Union had been. So he says, therefore, we must prevent the emergence of regional powers that might aspire to a world role. He's got a special place for Russia, because Russia is the only country that retains the ability to destroy the United States and the invisible government types along with it. So that's the Wolfowitz doctrine. It's highly unrealistic, and it is devoted then to blocking the normal development of a return to equilibrium in the world situation. At the same time, you've also got tendencies going on around Clinton. The neocons were extremely unhappy with Clinton because they always wanted Clinton to take military action. Clinton had many flaws, but he seemed to have understood the basic lesson of Vietnam: don't get involved in aggressive wars abroad. Clinton invaded Haiti. He also bombed Serbia. It's interesting that the bombing of Serbia took place really only under the shadow of impeachment, when Clinton had mortgaged his entire presidency to avoid being thrown out of office. The bombing of Serbia in the spring of 1999 was conducted by people like Gore, Albright, Cohen, Shelton, Richard Clark, the hero of the 9/11 Commission hearings, and a group of other bureaucrats. The goal was a kind of a proxy war with Russia. And indeed, if you look at the way the bombing went, it was on the one side designed to humiliate Russia, and then with the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, also a kind of a proxy attack on China. The hatred of the United States in the world goes back not so much to the post-9/11 period, but to the bombing of Serbia in the spring of 1999. Only a year after that, you've got the Kursk, the sinking of a Russian submarine in the Barents Sea, and at that time the headline in Pravda read, World War III almost happened on Saturday. During the Serbian episode, you had President Yeltsin coming forward saying, If you invade Serbia on the ground, you will get a European war and perhaps the Third World War. And towards the end of it, when General Wesley Clark, a military madman, was trying to take over an air base in Kosovo, he was told by the British commander, "I'm not starting World War III for you." So all during the 1990s, the neocon faction, the invisible government, were becoming more and more distressed, a little bit like England watching Germany before 1914. They see China coming up, and they see that the U.S. is going essentially nowhere, and they think that they have to resolve the world situation with some kind of a military active force. When Bush comes in, they expect a change. They think that Bush is going to be more aggressive. And the case then becomes the American spy plane that was forced down on the coast of China in the spring of 2001 through a collision with a Chinese interceptor. At that point, if you look at the neocon press, they were clamoring, use this incident for thermonuclear confrontation with China, force China to back down, promote a CIA people power revolution of the Eastern European type in China, and bust up your main world competitor for the next century or so. And what did Bush do? Bush did nothing. He kept sleeping for 14 hours a day, running for 3 hours a day. He did absolutely nothing. I think this is one of the important roots of 9/11. The neocons had gone through the 1990s yearning for military action. Clinton wouldn't give it to them except in this one case when the Principals Committee did it, not even Clinton. Then later on, Bush comes into power and doesn't give them what they want. So the conclusion on the part of the neocons and the invisible government types is, this government has so much inertia that it doesn't respond to presidential commands. The only way you can move this government and this society into the war-fighting mode that they think is essential to avoid collapse in the short to medium term is massive recourse to state-sponsored terrorism, provocations, and what we saw on 9/11. As they do it, they're concerned again with military strategy. They've also got to be concerned about the dollar, because the Anglo-American finance system, of course, is based on the residual role of the dollar as a world reserve currency. In other words, the ability of the United States to print greenbacks and import what is currently $750 billion a year of merchandise, where you're not earning the foreign exchange to pay for that, you're simply greenbacks and flooding the world with them. During the course of the late 1990s and the early part of this century, the euro appeared as a credible alternative to the dollar. The yen had always been one on a regional basis. And a series of countries began dumping the dollar in favor of the euro. North Korea did it. Saddam Hussein did it. He said, we don't want dollars for our oil, we want euros. He had the Oil for Food Fund, which the neocons are so upset about. He said, transfer that $10 or $12 billion from dollars into euros. It was a heavy blow for the dollar when that took place. Under these sanctions, of course, 500,000 to 1 million people were killed, but the neocons don't care about that. They're concerned about somebody embezzling some money on the side. Anyway, if you had a situation where Russia, Iran, Indonesia, Algeria, and a couple of other developing countries that are also oil producers were to switch the postage price from dollars into euros, you would begin to see a collapse of this tremendously bloated U.S. currency. The U.S. has foreign obligations which are unbalanced. In other words, the net foreign exposure of the U.S. is more than $3 trillion of securities. We've got a situation today in the world where there were $300 trillion worth of derivatives. Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase alone has about $50 trillion of derivatives. Suffice it to say that $50 trillion is more than the whole U.S. is worth. It's a multiple of what the U.S. would be worth under this entire system that we've got today. So somehow, the agenda of international affairs had to be shifted from questions of economic self-interest, monetary reform, restructuring the world economy, to the single-minded emphasis on terrorism, and then, of course, aggression in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now the danger of adding Iran to the list. We have to remember that in the mid-1990s, in addition to the Wolfowitz Doctrine, we had Bernard Lewis, the leading Arabist of the Anglo-American world, an agent of the British Arab Bureau since the time of, well, the late 1930s, coming forward with this phrase, the clash of civilizations. He developed this around the first Gulf War. The clash of civilizations argument was then taken up by Samuel Huntington, who's one of the most extreme of the neocon thinkers. Huntington is associated with the idea of the enemy image. It's an idea he got from Carl Schmitt back in Germany in the Weimar Republic. Schmitt says that the essence of politics is friend and foe. And Huntington's view is that if you want to have a functioning society, especially an oligarchical one, you've got to have an enemy image. And if there's not a real enemy image, you've got to create one. So the communist enemy image had somehow dissipated. So Huntington comes up with the idea that it's going to be a clash of civilizations, and above all, it's going to be the dominant Anglo-American world force against challenger civilizations. Who are the challengers? Well, Islam. Why? Not because of anything that the propaganda tells you, but because of the fact that Islam happens to have the highest birth rate, which the Anglo-Americans simply cannot match. The other one is, of course, China. Here, because of the unmatched rate of economic development, 8, 10, 12% a year, tremendous economic progress. So from Huntington's point of view, the next series of decades is the Anglo-American dominant force attempting to deal with Islam first, the entire array of Arab and Islamic states, followed then by some apocalyptic confrontation with China, with Russia lurking in the background. Now, this is absolute insanity. It's also worth noting Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book, The Grand Chessboard, is obviously as an anti-Russian, petty Polish aristocrat, or szlachcic, as they're known in Polish, the sort of lowest level of the local gentry with all kinds of pretensions and humiliations. He's interested in the five Central Asian republics going in to Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and so forth, and attempting to siphon out oil, but also bases so that you can prevent the coalescence of Eurasia into some kind of unified strategic force that would be able to counterbalance London and Washington and New York. The project for the new American century is a kind of a vulgarization at an even more primitive level of these ideas. Brzezinski, before I leave him, of course, is in the great tradition of Karl Haushofer, who was the geopolitical advisor to Hitler. So in all of these cases, when you're dealing with neocons, you find that their guru, Leo Strauss, was practically a Nazi in his own life. He happened to be Jewish, so he couldn't really become a party member. But in every other phase of his thinking, he mimicked pretty closely the Nazi intellectuals of the time. His great patron was Carl Schmitt, who was Hitler's main legal advisor. There is a role for oil in all this. Part of it is the desire to deny oil to one's strategic adversaries. That's one side of it. The other side is to secure it for yourself. Some people have argued that peak oil somehow plays a part in this. I regard this as an absurd thesis, not proven, not substantiated, based on no empirical evidence, based simply on Malthusian prejudice, based on arguments coming from the Venetian kook, Gian Maria Ortes, the Belgian theoretician Verhulst, Malthus himself, and then the research department of Royal Dutch Shell. We have to remember that Royal Dutch Shell was the research bureau that staged the two fake, phony, hoped-up oil crises of 1973 with a 400% increase in 1979 with a 200+% increase in the price of oil, and they're now doing it for the third or fourth or fifth time. So this is not the issue, but if you look at the beginning of World War II, you'll see Stalin's tanks are pointed towards Ploiești, Romania, which is Hitler's main source of oil. Hitler's tanks are pointed toward Baku, which is Stalin's main source of oil. The Japanese are pointed towards the Dutch East Indies to make that their primary source of oil. When you get a tendency to grab at oil, you also have an idea that you may be on the verge of a world war. So if we put this all together, we get a mood where the invisible government feels that their opportunities are slipping away. They see China developing. They see Russia at least stabilizing itself under Putin. They see the population growth in the Arab world, and they feel that time is against them and that they've got to act in some spectacular way to reorder world affairs, in effect with the help of some infernal machines that they build into the trade towers in New York. And with this, they hope to save the Anglo-American world position as a whole. Now, this is an act of utter, incalculable folly. It will only, it represents, in a sense, a psychotic flight forward from one series of insoluble problems to a worse series of insoluble problems. It shows that the Anglo-American finance oligarchy, as a ruling class, has failed utterly. They've become heroin addicts, and the heroin addict, the heroin to which they're addicted, is that of terrorism. One dose of heroin requires another dose. The dose has to be increased. The effects decline. We've had 9/11, and as I sit here towards the end of August of 2005, the world is full of talk of a new 9/11. Richard Cheney has told the Pentagon, be ready for a new 9/11, which will become the pretext for an attack on Iran, possibly and or North Korea, perhaps a little bit further down the road. So the heroin addict is now looking for another massive dose of the same heroin that he's been taking. And you can see that this leads us to a tragic situation. It's fair to say that in the United States today, the social order, property relations, politics, the Bush presidency, the Republican Party, and perhaps even more the Democratic Party, all based on the 9/11 myth. The Democratic Party, because they can't talk about Afghanistan or Iraq as long as that lasted, but the Democrats say they are the true worshippers at the altar of Bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and the rest of it, whereas Bush has not kept the faith, but has been diverted by Saddam Hussein and Mullah Omar and these people. So it's a situation where we're poised on the brink of new synthetic terrorism, possibly on the nuclear, biological, or chemical level. The nuclear one is attractive to the invisible government because it would give a moral, political justification for a nuclear response vis-a-vis Iran with bunker-busting mini-nukes and things like this. And it's simply a blind alley. The only thing that can happen is a kind of overthrow of the 9/11 myth. I would say, as they say in the Watergate parlance, all the trees in the forest will fall. And when that happens, just give me 1 second. Okay. So all the trees in the forest will fall, and the myth will be destroyed.
Well, it was just here. We thought it was part of the deal. What do we know?
All right, fine. We're going. Yeah, sure. We're going. We're going. Okay. I hope it's usable. I'm sure they'll find something at the end.
Sure.